And may the record reflect that a quorum is present. To begin with, I wanted to thank the members for putting up with kind of the change and majority shifts as a result of this last election. And quite honestly, I'm looking really forward to working with all of you, Democrats and Republicans alike, because I know many of them from past work with the legislature. And quite honestly, I think we have a really great committee membership roster. Every one of them, well, the new members have yet to prove themselves.
Oh.
But, starts right in there.
But the existing members that have served before certainly have a record of involvement and a good experience of participating in discussion and debate. As most of you know, the Judiciary Committee does not necessarily reflect a lot of the rancor that you sometimes find in other areas of legislating. We have a very broad scope in this committee. We have the responsibility of funding the courts, all of the partnered associations with the courts, as well as the Department of Public Safety and Corrections. But we also have the responsibility of reviewing other legislation. Constitutional amendments come through this committee. Issues usually that are extremely controversial come through this committee. And yet at the same time, I kind of reflect the membership and the debate as something reflective of what courtroom debate happened, how that happens. You have attorneys advocating for causes and principles and clients, and it's all right to have vigorous debate and principle debate, but after the debate, we seem to all get along. And it's been a long tradition of the Minnesota Senate Committee to have that type of working relationship. Our ranking member, Senator Latz, I know, and have a tremendous amount of respect for him, his work as an attorney, as well as the DFL members. They all have a participatory role in this committee, and I'm looking forward to it. What I'd like to do is have go around the table and have the members introduce themselves, a little quick bio, and maybe where you come from, that type of thing. So, Senator Thompson, why don't we start on your end?
My name is Dave Thompson, and I'm from Senate District 36, which covers Lakeville and Farmington and some of the smaller towns and townships to the south and east of Farmington. I have been a law practitioner for about 23 years and did some work in the media as well. And it's an honor to serve on Senator Limmer's committee, and I hope that we can follow through on the desire I think we all have to have a robust debate, but in the end try to do what's best for the folks. And I'm looking forward to working with everybody here.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Senator Hall.
Yep, I'm Dan Hall. I'm out of District 40, which is Burnsville and Bloomington, a little precinct in Savage. Puts me in three different counties. And I've been a minister for 30 years. Right now, do more of a police chaplaincy and train a certified police chaplains. And very interested in this committee and glad to be here.
I'm Barb Goodwin. I'm from Senate District 50, which is Arden Hill, Shoreview, New Brighton, Columbia Heights, Fridley, Hilltop, and St. Anthony. So a lot of cities. I have just come back, first time in the Senate, 6 years in the House, left in early 2007, end of 2006, and have been teaching at Hamline Graduate School, legislative practice, and government contracting, and also in the school board in Columbia Heights. Before I served my 6 years in the House, I was also director of central staff in the Minnesota House for about 10 years. And that's pretty much it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Marty.
John Marty, represent seven suburbs north of St. Paul, and have enjoyed this committee. I chaired this committee at one point, I think, even, yes. And it's a great committee.
Yeah, I agree.
And pardon?
I said I agree.
We have some good, robust debates, and in a lot of coming around in things that often aren't partisan ways other issues tend to be. Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm Julianne Ortman. I serve in the Senate since 2002 from Carver County and part of Scott County. I am a lawyer by trade. I have been practicing for more than 20 years, business law and litigation. In the last couple of years, I've been working in the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office as a senior administrative manager. And I have served on the Judiciary Committee since I started, since 2003. And it's been a fascinating place. The conversation is not partisan. I see partners around this table, Senator Scheid and Senator Letts. We've worked on legislation together. And so, and Senator Marty, and so this is a great committee. I'm really excited to work with all of you.
Senator Letts.
Well, I'm Ron Letts. I represent Senate District 44 at St. Louis Park, Hopkins, and most of Golden Valley, suburbs just west of Minneapolis. This is my first time on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, but I was on the Public Safety Budget Division before that as Vice Chair. I served on the Civil Law Committee in the House for 2 years. So I was in the House for 4 years. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I have my own solo practice, some criminal and some civil work for the past 22 years. The first 6 years of practice, I was in the Attorney General's office in the Public Safety and Human Services divisions. And I served on a city council before I came to the legislature. So I've seen the impact of the law on local governments directly as well as at the state level. I do look forward to serving with Chairman Limmer and the other members and to that robust discussion.
Senator Newman.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Newman. I am an attorney from Hutchinson, Minnesota. My district is Senate District 18, which is all of McLeod County, Meeker County, and the western edge of Wright County. And I am here replacing Senator Dill, who retired after the last session. I've noticed that the jurisdiction of this particular committee is very broad, and so I can tell you I'm looking forward to very much getting to know all of you and serving on this committee. Senator Dillon.
I'd also like to introduce Allison Garby. She's our CLA and my personal legislative assistant. No one gets out of here without saying something into a microphone, so Allison, we're going to give you the mic.
Okay, well, I'm Allison. If you have any questions, feel free to gear them towards me, and I will do my best to answer them.
And I'm Warren Limmer. I represent Northwest Hennepin County. Like Senator Ortman, every year I've been in the legislature, I've been on a judiciary committee, and that includes the 6 years prior to my 16 in the Senate in the House. And so I am not an attorney, and most people know that, but some people have accused me of being an attorney wannabe, and especially Senator Knuth, or former Senator Knutson out there in the audience. Nevertheless, I'm familiar with the issues that come before this committee, and Senator Ortman's right. This is probably one of the most interesting committees because we have just a whole myriad of issues that come before it. And it seems like every 20 to 30 minutes there's some new issue that's not related to the previous issue, and so it keeps the debate fresh. It's interesting, and you really begin to know how your members tick when they're on this committee, and if they're a contributing member, it really is probably one of the most rewarding experiences in the legislature, at least for me.
I'm Linnea Michelson. I'm with Senate Republican Research, and I've been covering this committee for several years, and this will be my sixth session with the Senate. Happy to be here.
I'm Kathy Pontius. I'm one of the two Senate counsel for the committee, and I've been with Senate counsel since December of 82 and with the Judiciary Committee since, I think, the 85 session, and I handle the civil law issues and data practices and privacy.
I'm Ken Backus. I'm the other counsel for the committee. I do the criminal justice issues. This is my 17th session here at the Senate, and I've done criminal justice the entire time.
My name is Chris Turner. I'm the committee fiscal analyst, and this is my 21st session.
Andrew. That's a lot of experience. My name is Bill Ingebrigtsen, Senate District 11. I come from 303 upstairs. That's where I come from, actually. where I've been spending a lot of time trying to organize my next meeting, which is I'll be chairing the Environmental Natural Resource at 3 o'clock. I've had the opportunity and the privilege to sit on this committee for the last 4 years, and I've enjoyed it a lot. And I'm very concerned, I think, as everybody is, about the funding or the lack thereof for the judiciary. And there's been a lot of discussion last year with regards to that. I'm sure we're going to hear some of that today. But we have a bunch of professionals here, I'll tell you, that I worked with in my other life as a former sheriff for 35 years, and a lot of familiar faces that come before the committee. And it's a real privilege, and I'm looking forward to the next putting a bill together that makes good sense and keeps all of Minnesotans in mind. Thanks.
I'm Gretchen Hoffman. I am from Senate District 10, which is Otter Tail County, Wadena County, a little corner of Becker County up north. I, like Senator Limmer, am not an attorney. I am a small business owner and a registered nurse, so I hope to bring a little different perspective as one of the people out there in the world that has to abide by all the laws that come out of this chamber. So I'm looking forward to serving on this committee with all of you.
I'm Linda Scheid, representing Senate District 46, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park and all of Brooklyn Center, next door to the chair's district in the northwest suburbs. And I forgive my flippancy. I wanted to be on the Judiciary Committee 4 years ago so I could mess with other people's bills. I had so much trouble coming before this committee historically. So, and I found it was great fun. No, I really do enjoy the committee. I trained it as an attorney. I do not practice, but I have enormous respect for the chair and am looking forward to working with you.
Senator Harrington.
Well, as the most junior senator here, with the least experience, actually was zero, this is my first committee meeting of any kind, so I'm happy to be here. I have 33 years as a police officer for the city of St. Paul, the last six as the chief of police. I've been a professor of criminal justice and law enforcement for the last 24 years at Metropolitan State University, and I'm happy to be here. This was my number one pick for where I wanted to serve, and having appeared before the committee on a number of occasions, I also thought it was a lot of fun. So,
all right. Thank you. I keep calling you Chief. Chief of Police, and so I have to learn the new vernacular. You have to go by Senator here. I also would like to introduce our committee administrator, Angela Starks. And Angela, if you could just take a moment at the microphone.
My name is Angela, and I've worked for Senator Limmer for several years, and so I'm just happy to be part of the committee. And if you have any questions, please give me a call.
And we also have other staff. Andrew, do you want to go first?
Thank you. My name is Andrew Matthews, and I'm the page for the Judiciary Committee here, and I'm very grateful for the chance to work with Chairman Limmer and his staff and all of you, so please let me know if there's any way I can help you have the most productive time during your committee meetings here. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Andrew has not worked in the legislature before, so this is his first eye-opening experience in how things really work. So it'll be a rewarding experience, I hope. And Megan Johnson is also here.
Hi, I'm Megan Johnson, and I work in Senate DFL Research. This is my seventh session with them.
All right. Well, introductions are done. We're going to start hearing from the court system today. This is more of an informational meeting, trying to understand and give our new members an opportunity to learn the interworkings and the interrelationship between the court system and some of the officers of the court, such as the defense and prosecutors on the criminal side. And I'd like to introduce our Chief Justice, Lori Gilday. If you would come forward. And Chief, you have a number of different participants that are going to be with you today. I think what I'm going to do is allow you to introduce them as they come up. But, Chief, you can proceed anytime you want.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Gilday. I have the honor of serving as your Chief Justice. I also chair the Coalition preserve Minnesota's justice system. We are grateful for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. I'm going to start out by saying a few words about the coalition, and then I'll talk about the role and challenges facing the judiciary, and then I'll ask my colleagues, members of the coalition who are here today, to in turn speak about their organizations and the challenges facing them. Our objective today is to paint for you a big picture of Minnesota's justice system. And we come before you today not on behalf of judges, attorneys, probation officers, law enforcement. We come today on behalf of the abused little girl who needs protection. We come today on behalf of the small business owner who is seeking to enforce her contract, the tenant seeking return of her security deposit, and the state holding an offender accountable in pursuit of safety and security for all of our communities. The justice system exists not for those of us at this table or for those of us who work in that system every day. The justice system exists for all Minnesotans. All 5 million Minnesotans are our constituents. Now, the coalition reflects the fact that our justice system is a highly interdependent ecosystem. As depicted on the first page of our handout, the component parts of our justice system are inextricably connected. What happens to one part deeply impacts all of the other parts. And in recent years, increasing budget constraints have highlighted that reality. The coalition was formed in the fall of 2008 in an effort to prevent further deterioration of our justice system. You have a list of current coalition members on page 2 of our handout. And as you can see, it includes law enforcement, prosecution, defense, victims advocacy, state and local bar associations, labor, and other civic groups. The coalition is here today to give voice to the Minnesota justice system. And that system, represented here today by the coalition, is at the breaking point. Ensuring access to justice is a core function of our government that our citizens expect and that our citizens deserve. Yet, many parts of Minnesota's justice system are faced with significant service reductions due to insufficient funding for staff and operations. Justice system spending has been reduced to a level which jeopardizes the right of Minnesotans to receive the timely resolution of civil and criminal matters, a right promised to all of our citizens and embodied in our Constitution. And that's what we're here to talk to you about this afternoon. I'm going to just start with a description of the judicial branch, the challenges we are facing, the efficiency measures we are undertaking to adjust to the budget realities that some have begun to call the new normal. And I also want to touch on the impact of further budget reductions. Each of my justice system partners will do likewise for their respective organizations. The mission of the judicial branch is to provide equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. The branch is comprised of 315 judges and 2,500 employees. Our annual budget is approximately $285 million. which is less than 2% of the state's general fund. We operate in each of our 87 counties, and we handle about 1.7 million cases every year. From abuse and neglect of children and vulnerable adults to commercial and business disputes, traffic tickets, to first-degree murder offenses. We do not control our workload. We must take each and every case that is filed, and we are mandated by our state constitution to handle every case, civil and criminal, promptly and without delay. As page 3 of our handout indicates, everything comes through our doors. Our court system is the backbone of our democracy. It protects the most vulnerable among us. It ensures the rule of law, essential to an ordered civil society. It promotes stability and accountability required for commercial activity to thrive. And it is the gateway to justice for all, as promised in our Constitution. Over the past 3 years, the judiciary has experienced base budget reductions totaling almost $19 million. This has left us operating nearly 10% short-staffed and 20 judges short of our need. These budget challenges have caused unacceptable delays in our ability to dispense timely justice. I'm going to give you just a few examples of how this is being felt around our state. 1 in 4 serious felonies is now taking more than a year to get resolved in Minnesota. In Olmsted County, felony trials are being scheduled for April of 2012. In Douglas County, it now takes almost twice as long to get a misdemeanor trial as it did just a couple of years ago. And for 30% of the abused children who are taken out of their home, it takes more than a year for those children to learn where their permanent home is going to be. These delays are not acceptable. They are not what Minnesotans have come to expect, and they are not what Minnesotans deserve. Now, the courts have a vital government function to perform, and we are also keenly aware of our obligation to maximize the use of the scarce taxpayer dollars we are given. And so the judicial branch has been aggressive in searching for ways to contain costs. We instituted a hiring freeze, a pay freeze, a voluntary separation program, leave without pay, layoffs, and voluntary furloughs. We have cut positions throughout the system and flattened our management structure so that everybody is doing more. And we are redoubling our efforts to find more efficiencies, to redesign how we do what we do, and to expand the use of technology to reduce costs, while doing all we can to try to continue to provide Minnesotans with quality justice. I'll save most of the details of these innovations for our budget presentation, which will be later, but I want to give you just a few teasers. The first is we are moving the processing of 1 million payable citations that the courts handle every year from 87 counties into a centralized virtual payment center, where we have staff working around the state from home offices, processing the paper and electronic citations and supporting a statewide centralized call center. We are working with the law enforcement community to allow traffic citations to be entered into squad car computers, then transferred electronically to police and sheriff department's case systems, and then sent directly over the computer to the court's case management system, saving time for law enforcement and court staff. We are partnering with the BCA to implement e-charging This system will enable county attorneys to file criminal complaints electronically, again, saving time for law enforcement and court staff. We've expanded the use of ITV video conferencing for use in certain criminal proceedings to reduce travel time and costs for our justice system partners. And finally, we are implementing e-filing for civil cases, starting with a pilot project that began a few months ago in Hennepin County. The judicial branch has undertaken extraordinary efforts to find and implement efficiencies to keep functioning despite budget cuts and shortfalls. We recognize, however, that in matters of justice, with the constitutional mandates of due process, notice, and the opportunity to be heard, there are clear limitations on our ability to manage our way out of further cuts. As you can see from page 4 of our handout, the budget cuts and shortfalls that we have sustained in recent years have already taken a tremendous toll on our system. Thank you for everything that you have done and for everything that you will do to keep our justice system strong and fully functioning. I'm now going to turn to my friend and colleague, John Stewart, our state public defender.
Pardon me, Chief. Just as a word to the members, we're going to have a time for question and answer after the presentations. So if you have any, just hold them, and we'll have time later if anyone wants to ask questions. Mr. Stewart, welcome
to the
committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name's John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I feel lucky to live in a country and live in a state that has very high expectations of its justice system. We expect that the justice system will not only protect public safety, but also that it will protect people's constitutional rights. Now, to make those expectations a reality is a lot of work. And as you're going to hear, the work is done by people in organizations who are interconnected so that one problem in one area affects everyone. I'm going to give you examples of that in a minute. First, I would like to just give you a very short introduction to the public defense system in Minnesota. We work in every courthouse. We work in all 87 counties in Minnesota. We handle misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, felonies, juvenile cases, and appeals. Every one of our cases is a case where somebody is at risk of being locked up. We don't handle the things on a speeding ticket level. We handle cases that have the potential for someone to lose their liberty. That's why they have the constitutional right to counsel. We have 675 employees across the state. We have about 28 offices, and we have about 200 part-time lawyers that work as public defenders in the smaller counties. We cannot refuse any cases. We take everything that comes in the door, so we're not in a position to control our workload. We also work by, as we should, by the same ethical standards as any other lawyer practicing in Minnesota. The result is that public defenders have been highly motivated to be efficient. 97% of our budget goes into direct services to clients. We do our training with internal trainers, people from our own organization, not sending people away or hiring people to fly in to do training. We have a case information system that is just being installed now that piggybacks on the court's case information system. So if I'm interviewing a client, I don't have to ask her address and date of birth and write it down and then take it back to my office and type it into a computer. We can just do that by capturing the keystrokes that the courts have already done for us. We handle conflict cases with our own part-time staff, not by contracting them out. We're working with prosecutors to get into the next generation of technology where we will be exchanging documents electronically rather than passing huge piles of paper back and forth. But I must say, an awful lot of the work that public defenders do cannot be eliminated. You always need to meet the client, get the police reports, read the reports, talk to the prosecutor, go to court. These are kind of irreducible work functions that our folks do. And since 2008, we've lost 15% of our lawyer staff. That amounts to the equivalent of 63 full-time lawyers around the state. These losses create problems, of course, for our clients and for our staff and for crime victims and for witnesses and for everybody else who works in the justice system. And that's where I want to turn now, the interconnectedness part. The legislative auditor studied us and issued a report last February, which is on their website. Here's their number one conclusion. If you have a copy somewhere, it's on the executive summary. It's the top thing in the blue pages in the front. They say, public defender cases are too high, resulting in public defenders spending limited time with clients, difficulties preparing cases, and scheduling problems that hinder the efficient operation of the criminal courts. Well, I want to give you a couple of examples of how our shortage hinders the operation of the courts. Here's a story that a judge told the State Bar Association Assembly when the Assembly met on December 10th. That's the governing body of the State Bar Association. The judge gets up and says, recently I had an afternoon calendar with 17 pretrial conferences, had one public defender to handle those cases. But, bless you, she also was handling the sentencing calendar in another courtroom. So all afternoon, the one public defender is running back and forth between these two courtrooms. At any point during the day, one of the judges and the judge's staff and the prosecutors and the bailiffs and all the other people that are involved in a court, half of those people are spending their time waiting for the public defender to come back. Now, among the defendants that were in the 17 pretrials, there got to be kind of a row between a couple of them, and the sheriff had to be called up. And after that, one of the defendants got fed up and left the building. So that became a bench warrant case, referred to the sheriff's bench warrant staff. They have to go out now and pick the guy up and bring him back and book him in the jail. So you can see how the public defender shortage kind of rippled out to affect two judges and their staff and two sets of prosecutors and ultimately law enforcement when the sheriff had to do two extra jobs because of the public defender shortage. Second story. This is a story that the court administrator told the legislative auditors while they were writing this report. I'm just going to read it. It's only five short sentences. Court administrator says this. We have a two-hour omnibus hearing this Monday. A public defender's request to continue came in at 3:45 today, Friday. There are 16 officers subpoenaed to testify. The defendant is in custody. The public defender has not been able to get prepared. So besides the public defender client, a judge and a prosecutor and their staff, and 16 law enforcement officers are affected, plus the additional jail costs to the county of keeping the defendant in custody until the case could be rescheduled. Now, someone might say, well, then, deny the request for the continuance. I see some people are thinking, well, heck, we'll deny it. But most people who work in the courts know that this kind of request is legitimate. This might be the same public defender that they saw running back and forth between the different courtrooms the day before. Second, the defendant is entitled by the Constitution to effective assistance of counsel. So if the lawyer tries to face 16 police witnesses without preparing, there's going to be an appeal, and there's quite a likelihood to have the Court of Appeals order a do-over, and then you start the whole process again. So it's likely that that continuance would be granted. Which brings me to my last point, which is the point that Chief Justice emphasizes, which is delay. Besides Rochester, where they're setting into 2012, we have a lot of places around the state that are setting cases a year out because there are no places available to jam them in, and it's only January 11th of this year. In 2009 in Minnesota, the Court of Appeals reversed convictions and dismissed two cases of people who had been convicted of violent felonies because they hadn't got a speedy trial. One of them was a case in Ramsey County, State v. Griffin. This person was charged and convicted of an assault on a police officer. The case was dismissed because the defendant had their trial date continued 30 times due to people not being available to have the trial. Now, in California, when I think about California, I think about if you have a problem here and you want to see a place where the problem would be a lot bigger, you can look to California. California, a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court dismissed 18 criminal cases because of lack of a speedy trial. So in closing, I want to quote one short quote from a public official who said, "Cutting public defender staff would result in a dramatic reduction in the services provided to indigent defendants. Those layoffs could result in demands for speedy trials not being met and the inappropriate release of accused criminals." That's from a letter we got from Governor Pawlenty in 2004 telling us to please not lay off any public defenders. Unfortunately, in 2008, we had to do it. That brings us to the point we are now. We're down 15%. So I know many of you. I know that you'll give this problem a lot of attention, and thanks for giving me some time today to talk about this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now we'll hear from my friend and colleague, Gary Hurd from Civil Legal Services.
Mr. Hurd,
Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman, thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. I am Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, affectionately known as SMURLS by anybody who has to say that more than three times. I'm here today to talk on behalf of all of the civil legal services providers in the state. Our programs cover all 87 counties in Minnesota, and we provide free legal services to low-income and senior citizen clients. We help the tenants who are facing unlawful evictions. We help homeowners facing mortgage foreclosures. We help victims of domestic violence obtain safety through restraining orders. And we help persons with disabilities obtain benefits like Social Security disability income. The service that we provide to the justice system is, first off, we reduce the number of pro se or unrepresented parties that the courts have to deal with. Any of you who may be attorneys or others who have been in or observed court know that the process happens pretty quickly. If you do not have someone who can advise you on what's going on, very often people are leaving the courtroom not really knowing what happened. Although the courts have done a lot to try to help unrepresented people present their cases, it is a complicated system. In addition to representing those people, we also talk to a lot of clients or prospective clients who we advise you do not have a meritorious case. you should not be taking this to court. And so we help screen out a large number of cases that the courts don't have to deal with. In addition to the representation that we provide, we also provide community legal education, both materials and presentations, to groups like landlords or tenants to advise them on the basics of the law that applies to them and hopefully give them the tools to either avoid legal disputes or handle them without the need to take them to the courts. Those materials are available both in hard copy and also online. And so they're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in all 87 counties of Minnesota with computer access. In addition to those efficiencies, we also help leverage the amount of money that the state of Minnesota provides for these services. The just under $12 million annual appropriation grows to $33 million worth of services when we factor in the federal funds that we obtain, the funds we receive from the attorney registration fees for licensed attorneys in Minnesota, the funds we receive from the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account program, which is when attorneys have client funds that they need to hold in safekeeping, but they're not large enough or being held long enough to justify opening a separate account for that client. Those funds are deposited into a pooled account, and the interest from that pooled account is paid into the state and then is distributed to legal services providers. And lastly, we raise funds through private sources, both foundations and private donations. The work that we do helps all of your communities. We reduce homelessness, which reduces the need for services and for shelters. We allow people with disabilities to remain in their homes rather than have to be in more expensive institutions. We reduce domestic violence. There was a study done to try to determine what are the most important factors that will determine whether domestic violence is reduced in a community. And one of only two statistically significant factors was the presence of a legal services program in that community. So we work with all parts of the justice system at one point or another. And yet, because of funding cuts to our programs, similar to the public defenders, we have lost approximately 17% of our attorney staff statewide. And that translates into a reduction in services. I look forward to an opportunity to talk to all of you individually and in future committee hearings where we review our budget request, which is a request for flat funding this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reard.
Next, we're going to hear from Jim Backstrom from the County Attorneys Association, Cliff Paler here on behalf of labor, and Dave Pesha here on behalf of law enforcement. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll just sit back here.
That's fine, Chief.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Backstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be up here before this committee once again. I am James Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney. I appear today on behalf of Minnesota's county attorneys and also our colleagues in the city attorney's offices, our city prosecutors that do such fine work across our state. And I'm here to tell you and to share the message that we're all in this together. As the chief indicated, when the handouts indicate, you know, anytime there's funding shortages in one area of our criminal justice system, it adversely impacts us all. And, you know, keep in mind, from that perspective, this is a law enforcement issue. When we talk about reducing services in our courts, cutting public defenders so we can't process cases in a timely and effective manner, all of our citizens suffer from that, and the basic protection of our public safety in our communities suffers when we don't have adequate resources to handle our justice system. County attorneys and city attorneys, as you know, are not funded directly by the state. We're funded at the local levels by our county boards or our city councils. And but as you also well know from your work, at least those of you that have been on this committee for a number of years and those that work in this area clearly know, when there are cuts to local government aid by the state, it adversely affects each and every part of county or city government, including our law enforcement and prosecution functions. When we queried my colleagues across the state in recent months about the impacts of budget reductions, the same stories you've heard from the public defenders and the civil legal aid folks in our court system apply to us as well. We are facing hiring freezes. We are facing reductions in staff. We are facing salary freezes. And we are doing our best to keep up with fewer resources. In my county, for example, Dakota County, our state's third largest, we have three less attorneys working in my office today than I had 3 years ago. I have also lost two support staff, and I can tell you that our caseloads are continuing to increase or at least remain steady, and the reduction in that staff places burdens upon my office as well as the offices of my colleagues across the state. Keep in mind, and I know you understand this, and I guess I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but you know, justice is not just for criminal defendants, although it's extremely important that those who are charged with crimes have access to an attorney when they can't afford one to represent them. That's an extremely important mandated constitutional right, and our public defenders need those resources to do their jobs, and they can't do it with 15% cuts. They simply can't do their jobs as effectively as they need to be done. But cuts in those aids, or justice, I should say, is for everyone. It's for the crime victims, the victims of crime when they occur. You know, they need justice, too, as does each and every one of our citizens, because every time we seek to protect the public safety, we're trying to protect each and every one of our citizens, and there is not a more important function that a government provides than to protect the safety of its citizens. And we need adequate funding across all of our justice system to be able to do that. I'll just say one quick word of support also for my civil legal aid colleagues. You heard from Gary Hurd. County attorneys in our state strongly support the need for funding for legal aid attorneys. I personally think they're the most underpaid and underappreciated attorneys in our society. They do wonderful work each and every day. It's life-changing work for the individuals who can't afford counsel that need those services, that are involved, enmeshed in our system of justice, not by their own need in many cases, but because, you know, others have committed crimes against them and the like. That's extremely important. And county attorneys and prosecutors can't go in to civil courts to seek restraining orders on behalf of these victims. They need to have their own attorneys and assistance to do that. Legal aid does an extremely important job in protecting our citizens in that work as well, and it's critical to our justice system. There are some unintended consequences I just ask you to keep in mind when cuts are made to the public defenders, for example. Some of those responsibilities that previously were provided by public defenders are now being pushed back to county government to pay for. One example is the representation of parents in child protection cases, which for years was provided by the public defender through funding from this legislature. The funding is gone, and we certainly can understand their need to make cuts and that, but that's also a mandated service that those parents receive legal representation, and now the counties are paying for that. We think that's an unintended consequence of reducing state funding for public defenders, which really is, quite frankly, an unfunded mandate on county government, and it should be brought back to the state level. There are other examples, too, with the expert witness costs, cost of discovery, and the like. And as John Stewart and the chief indicated, we are working hard on innovations and efficiencies in our system of justice. Prosecutors are a big part of that as well. In Dakota County, we have a group called CGIN. You may have heard of it, the Criminal Justice Integration Information Network, which has been a leader in establishing new tools for police officers to use and sharing information amongst each other and with the prosecutor's offices and ultimately with our public defenders as we prosecute cases. Extremely important work. We're using those e-charging and e-discovery opportunities, and we'll continue to use those. But we do need the resources, as John Stewart has said. The people need to be there to review these cases because computers can't do it. You know, you can't review a case to decide whether someone should be charged with a crime and have a computer spit out whether it's a yes or a no. You've got to look at the facts. You've got to look at all the circumstances, and you have to use your professional judgment in making those difficult calls. And as many of you may know, up to a third of the cases that are reviewed by prosecutors' offices are never charged, are never brought into our system of justice, but they still require review, and that is still serving the interests of justice because there are crime victims out there as well that we're looking at, and because but we cannot go forward without adequate evidence, and we should not, and that's the important role that a prosecutor plays in our system. Justice delayed in many respects is justice denied, as we've all heard before. And as I have heard Chief Justice Gilday and her predecessor, Chief Justice Magnuson, say on a number of occasions, and I will leave you with this thought, justice is not an option in our state. It is an obligation, and we need to make it a first and foremost interest of this legislature. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Next would be Mr. Paler.
If it pleased the chair, we can do it that way. I'm Clifford Paler. Mr. Chair, thank
you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Limmer. I appreciate it. again, my name is Clifford Paler. I'm the treasurer of AFSCME Council 5. That's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We have about 41,000 employees throughout members throughout the state and every one of the 87 counties. I'm also here with the blessing of Shar Knutson, who is the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And her own representative is also part of the coalition of Chief Gilday, as am I. In fact, I've been on the coalition along with Mr. Backstrom and Mr. Petra since its inception back in 09. And I remember Senator Ortman's boss, Rich Stanek, at the first press conference that we had last year, standing on one side of me and Mr. Backstrom standing on the other side of me. And it was the only time I'd been surrounded by law enforcement as a public defender that I felt comfortable. Because I'll tell you, just as a parenthetical, Mr. Backstrom, unlike most county attorneys in big outfits, he tries his own cases. And so when he tells you that he knows what's going on in the courtrooms of Dakota County, I can assure you he does. I've been in the courtrooms of Hennepin County for 26 years. The first case I ever had, probably by more luck than anything else, was dismissed. It was a Friday. I got back to work Monday, and I had a very irate client on the phone. I wondered why he was irate. It's because he was still in jail. So when I inquired as to how this could possibly happen, somebody said, well, gee, we're kind of understaffed, and it's getting a little tough, and we just can't cover all the bases. That was 26 years ago, and I can tell you it hasn't gotten any better. The real point I want to make is, I guess, two points. The first point I want to emphasize is what Mr. Backstrom, Mr. Petch, you've told, or is what Mr. Petch is going to tell you, is that, you know, from a public defense point of view, you could call this a constitutional crisis, and it is one. But what you really have here is what Mr. Backstrom told you have here. You have a law enforcement problem. This constitutional crisis has caused a law enforcement problem that is spreading throughout society. It is now becoming a societal problem. I'm in the courtrooms of Hennepin County every day. In the government center, there's 18 stories. The C side's the court side, and pretty much every floor is devoted to the courtrooms. At least the Senator Latz knows that any given day, four or five courtrooms are devoted to trials of both misdemeanor and felony, pretrials, omnibus hearings. The place is moving all day long. As you're moving through the hallways, you can hear things like a victim saying to the prosecutor, but I can't come back anymore. This is the third time. You will hear a witness say, I can't come down here anymore. You're wrecking my life. My boss is mad at me, or I'm privately employed. I can't keep doing this. Now, mind you, I'm a public defender. I hear these things. and it causes me a great deal of consternation for the health of the society that we live in. Victims of crimes will not get their redress if there aren't enough people to do the job. And I will also say, parenthetically, the city attorneys in Minneapolis, the county attorneys in Minneapolis, are woefully understaffed. It really wouldn't matter if you doubled their staff, because if you're not going to add to the public defender quotient and to the courts as a whole, you're really just putting the money in the wrong place. It's not going to be utilized properly. The other reason I wanted to come here today is as a representative of labor. 400,000 AFL-CIO employees, members, along with, I know, probably 60,000 Teamsters in the state of Minnesota. The Teamsters are also part, I believe, of Chief Justice Gilday's coalition. We support, on a bipartisan basis, as citizens of this state, from every township, from every county, from every town, from every city in this state, our members. You know, if you can't find a job, at least you can find a courtroom, or at least that used to be the case. If you couldn't have a job, you could still get a divorce, or you could still go through bankruptcy, or you could still go pay that snowbird ticket. Not anymore. Sometimes you come to court and the window's closed. I know Chief Justice Magnuson had gone down to Wabasha, Minnesota, only to find the courthouse door closed on a Wednesday. I think that's probably how the coalition got started. What I also wanted to say is, during the campaign that's now concluded, I got to know now Governor Dayton very well. I can tell you that he's very concerned about this issue. I can tell you that in my belief he will be a partner in this issue. He's asked me about funding issues. He's asked me to make sure that the Supreme Court and the public defenders get their budget to him as soon as possible. So I guess the way I look at this is not a government agency. It's the third branch of government. And I would hope that it wouldn't be treated as just another agency coming to you with their hand out in hard times. This is a core function of government. It's guaranteed by the Constitution. And people all over this state want a functioning judicial system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paylor. Representing the Minnesota Chiefs Police Association, Dave Pechia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dave Pechia. I'm currently the executive director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. After having retired from law enforcement after serving over 34 years, the last 16 plus years as the chief of police in Lionel Lakes. And I'm here just to discuss a little bit about the unintended consequences of the cuts to the judicial system for law enforcement and the communities that we serve. I'd like to, first of all, I have to make a little disclosure here. My brother has been a public defender for over 20 years in Ramsey County, and I never thought in my professional career I'd have to defend the public defenders. But what I have learned is that due to the lack of public defenders, it has critically impacted our ability to do our job, simply because, as predicted by then Anoka County Attorney Bob Johnson and current Assistant County Attorney Pete Ivey, that the lack of public defenders will grind the system to a halt. And we're starting to see that happen. From a law enforcement perspective, we're running into witnesses that are now hesitant to testify because it has taken so long from the time that they reported the crime or were a witness to a crime for it to come before a judge. We have heard from our victims. When we go back to the victim's residence for whatever reason, and they say to the law enforcement officers responding, "My case hasn't been heard yet. What are you going to do for me now?" And the fact that their case has been continued for the umpteenth time, or it was scheduled, the delay in scheduling was to the point that they feel like the law enforcement profession cannot help them in this situation. Now, many of our agencies have suffered cuts. I mean, there's been dissolutions of police departments throughout the state of Minnesota, and we've suffered our own budgeting challenges. And the sheriff's offices, many of which are not able to pick up that slack. They're not able to provide those services in which our local police departments have at one time provided. We're also seeing the budget cuts in the overtime costs paid to officers, like the example given before, the 16 officers there to testify. That becomes very expensive for a municipality, and because of the continuances, officers need to be there in case they are needed to testify, and then they don't, and it gets continued, and they're coming back more and more times. That's one thing for the officers to do that, but can you imagine what it's like for the witness, or more importantly, for the victim who has to return to court, and will this ever end for them? Now, another thing that we're seeing the courts doing is the implementation of payables. And for law enforcement, the payables, for the committee's knowledge, is converting an otherwise minor criminal offense to a civil violation. So what that means for law enforcement, in that the event that the officer makes a traffic stop and he is there to talk to the driver about what was at one time a criminal offense, it is now a payable, so it's a civil violation. So even though the officer has reasonable suspicion, they cannot go to that next step. They cannot ask that next question, because now they are dealing with the individual on a civil matter, not a criminal matter. Also, for the law enforcement agencies that are involved with community-oriented policing and problem-oriented policing philosophies, it's very important that we're able to have the tool of having a criminal offense available for us as leverage in getting the person to comply. And we use this for our neighborhood quality of life issues, for as a tool to take a small item and to make sure, a small incident, make sure it doesn't grow into a larger one, or to use it as a tool to, quite frankly, keep your neighborhood quiet and safe. Now, if we're going there on a loud party call and the last time we were there the person was charged, they haven't been to court yet. So our question is from the person that called, what are you going to do for me now? And if this turns into a payable, where it's not a criminal offense, we're losing that tool to get the person into the court system where it's heard before a judge who then can deliver some consequences. And at one time, they were timely consequences, and now we're losing that ability to have that. So those are just some of the examples of how these unintended consequences have affected law enforcement. And prior to today's hearing, I had sent an email to Shalene Johnson from the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women. And I asked Shalene, what has the effect of the slowing down of the court system, what has that done to you and your clients and the people that you serve? And she said, in part, she said, I can think of many consequences. Do you want examples from criminal courts? Do you want examples involving civil protection orders, divorce, child protection? I have worked in all the courts and can think of situations with all of them. So it's affecting many, many people. And I'm just here on behalf of law enforcement to explain how it has affected us and our ability to do our job.
Thank you, Mr. Bechia. Next on the list, representing the Minnesota Bar Association, is Mr. Terry Votel. And accompanying him is Judge Knutson. I've actually been waiting for Judge Knutson to be before my committee for a long time.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Terry Votel. I have the privilege of serving as president of the Minnesota State Bar Association this year. Many years ago, before I had that privilege, many, many years ago, I grew up in a family of nine over in the west side of St. Paul. When you happen to have an activity that got you home for a meal late, there wasn't much left over sometimes. I'm getting that feeling again today. You've heard from a lot of lawyers. You've heard from lawyers on the criminal side. You've heard from lawyers on the civil side. So I will try to be efficient in my remarks out of respect for your time. Minnesota State Bar Association is a voluntary group of 17,000 lawyers throughout the state of Minnesota. We are a member of the coalition, and we support adequate funding of the judiciary. We are joined by the other bar associations who appear on the list of the coalition members. Some of those are the district bar associations, Hennepin County Bar, Ramsey County Bar, the specialty bar associations such as Minnesota Defense Lawyers, Minnesota Association for Justice. I would add that we also engage the district bars across the state of Minnesota. I had the opportunity on Friday to drive to Dawson, Minnesota for a meeting of the 12th District Bar Association and the attorneys and judges who are a member. The same exact discussion that's occurred here today, the concerns that are expressed here today occurred in that district meeting. So the issue is truly a statewide issue, covers every corner, every court in the state of Minnesota. It's pretty clear to all of you that the justice system doesn't exist for lawyers. It exists for our friends, our neighbors, our citizens, for lawyers, for our clients across the state of Minnesota. Those are individuals. They are business owners, whether it be a small business or whether it be a major corporation. They all have the need from time to time to access the justice system for the redress of their rights and for protection of their property rights. The issues that they bring before the courts aren't necessarily extraordinary issues. They're common issues that we're all familiar with. And I would just highlight a couple of those, and I want to pick up in highlighting those issues both for individual citizens that access the court and for businesses that access the court, the importance of a statement that the Chief Justice made in her remarks of the timely access to justice. You can imagine the individual who may be in an abusive or a neglectful situation and needs the help of the courts to cure that issue. You can imagine somebody that is experiencing harassment or maybe even stalking, something of that nature, and the fact that they need a responsive court system to help them in those circumstances. We all perhaps have had situations where you have a vulnerable family member or a vulnerable neighbor, and the protection that person needs and that the court system intervention that's required in those situations. If that doesn't occur in a timely manner, those folks suffer some awful dire consequences. So I would accentuate the timeliness of the services provided by the judicial system as being ever important, and of course that's a direct function of proper funding of the justice system. We in Minnesota strive to maintain a business climate that's very receptive to businesses, in which businesses can be created, in which they can flourish. Those businesses also require access to the judicial system in order to protect themselves from time to time. They may have a contract that needs enforcement. They may have a significant amount collectible that they have to pursue in court. You can imagine as a small business owner how important that is to a business owner to be able to collect those funds so that they can continue to operate their business, continue to employ the persons they employ, and to prosper within the state of Minnesota. They have to access our judicial system for regulatory matters, licensure matters, all kinds of matters that businesses have to address and access the justice system. Chief Judge Perez of the Minnesota Tax Court is here today and just joined us, and had pointed out to me that although it's not part of this budget, businesses and individuals across the state of Minnesota also have to access tax courts, Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the services of the Office of Administrative Hearings. While it's not part of the main court budget, it has the same consequences if it's not adequately funded, so I would point that out also. I'm not trying to make the point the hard way. The point is that delays and a lack of timeliness in addressing some of the important issues that folks bring before the courts has some pretty disastrous consequences upon them, has some pretty unacceptable consequences for our society, too. We operate under a rule of law. You all know what that is. We have a constitutional guarantee of access to justice for all citizens. Those things begin to be compromised if the courts are not adequately funded. So I would join with all the other members of the coalition in thanking you for your time and asking for your support in properly funding the justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Votel. Judge Knutson.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is David Knutson. I'm a district court judge down in Dakota County in the 1st Judicial District. It's my distinct pleasure to be here and to testify in front of you today and see all these friendly faces. And I had the distinct privilege of serving in this body for 12 years, and for most of that time serving on this committee. So I appreciated the comments that went around the table and the nature of this committee, which was and is always viewed in a bipartisan manner, and struggles with a lot of very difficult issues, but does so in a very open and transparent and again, as I mentioned, a bipartisan way. So it was a pleasure for me to serve on this committee when I was in the Senate. I want to give you some examples from the trenches, and you know, without digging into my deep past or the 6 years, I'm just going to take a little snippet from yesterday. So yesterday, I have what we call the special term calendar. So I'm hearing motions and evidentiary hearings. I had 12 cases on in just the morning. So that gives me about 15 minutes per case. And it's my understanding I have the first appeal of a conceal and carry issue in Dakota County. That took almost an hour and a half. And I have to determine in that time period whether or not somebody is a danger to self or others. I also had an insurance case dispute regarding a fire to a homeowner and a remodeling case that involved six different parties. And I have to hear from the six different lawyers that are involved in that case. I had motions for summary judgment, dismissing lawsuits, and would in disposing of the case that these people had brought. Several of them were personal injury cases with serious injuries, but they all involved very important legal issues. I also had a child custody post decree matter where the parties parents couldn't get along still and still disagree on where that child should reside. So I had 15 minutes per case. And so when we talk about our budget and budget cuts that we've suffered over the last 4 years, we're talking about delays. And I think Senator Marty coined the phrase, it's becoming McJustice. And it's drive-by justice. And the one thing that we do and the one thing that all of you do that makes a difference to your constituents is that you listen. And I found that out in a big way about 3 months ago when I sentenced a gentleman to prison. He was before me on a probation violation. We had a relatively brief hearing, and there was a sense of what was going to happen. But I asked him, I said, when is this going to end? What's going on in your life? How did you get here? And he started to explain it to me. And he told me the story of the mistake that he made as a young man and how he ended up getting caught up in the system and a probation violation after violation as he's trying to get his life together. And he felt that this was the end of the line, that this was going to be his turning point and that this was the last time he would be in front of us. I said, all right, then I'm sentencing you to prison. Bailiffs, you may take him. So as he's being led off, and he's going back out through the doors into the holding cell, he said, hold on a second. And the bailiff started grabbing him. And he said, no, I need to say something to the judge. But by that time, I'm pretty much on to my next case. And he said, no, I have to say something. I said, no, let me hear from him. And so he turned around and he said, Judge, thanks for listening. Nobody listens anymore. Thank you. And with that, he turned and went. But that just brought home the point so clear to me that this is a job about listening. And when I have 15 minutes for 12 cases each yesterday, I have to absorb the testimony of all the parties, listen to the arguments of the attorneys, and then come to some kind of a conclusion in my own mind. I take it under advisement, but we have to, as a justice system, spend that time listening and make sure that the people that appear in front of us, the litigants, the parties, the lawyers, feel like they're getting justice. And Senator Marty, I think you'll agree that McJustice doesn't give us time to listen. And that's basically what's happening. When we get cut, we have delays. We can work faster. I can get that down to those 12 cases instead of 15 minutes. I can try to get it down to 12 minutes or 10 minutes. But I'm telling you, that's not what the people that both you and I serve expect as justice. So we've got delays that are both inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom. When you talk about punishing somebody and sentencing somebody, and it's a year and a half after the incident occurred, or after they were charged, it's hard to connect that punishment to that act. It's hard to correct that act when there's no connection between the punishment and the act that was committed. So I would ask you to think about some of these examples, and I know that this committee, as I mentioned, we are in very, very good hands as I look around this table. But to emphasize with your colleagues and with the executive branch that further delays are going to significantly impact the constitutional rights of the citizens that we all took an oath of office to serve. I know that you're going to be good stewards of our funds and that you're going to do what you can to make sure that the judicial system is adequately funded. So in closing, I just want to thank you for the work that you're going to do this year and for the importance that you view the judicial branch. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Judge, for those wise words. Thank you. Before we get into a question and answer time, we have a new member that did not have an opportunity to be here at the opening bell. Senator Jungbauer, could you take 1 minute to just introduce yourself to the audience? And
all right. Senator Mike Jungbauer from Senate District 48, the north end of the metro, and I do apologize for being late. I had a lunch appointment, and I find out the one thing you can't control in Minnesota is weather and driving conditions thereof. So normally I'm very timely, so I take it very serious to be on time. I'm very happy to be here. I wanted to be on judiciary since I've been here in the Senate. This is the start of my third term, and I'm excited to be here.
Right. Thank you. Members, if there's any questions, now's the time to raise them. Anybody have any need to ask questions? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chief Justice. When your predecessor was before this body during the last budget cycle, there was a lot of talk about expanding the list of payables or decertifying misdemeanors to petty misdemeanors, and the courts presented a substantial list with the idea of being able to process those cases more efficiently and with less judicial resources. The legislature, in its wisdom, decided it was not appropriate or was not willing anyway to go along with the entire list and left a lot of those cases in the criminal calendars. But the resources didn't necessarily follow to be able to process those cases efficiently. There were questions raised about whether for those cases that became payables but also had substantial collateral consequences, such as driver's license revocations or suspensions that automatically followed by state statute from those convictions, even if they were as petty misdemeanors, whether there was appropriate notice given or whether there's enough process allowed. Have you had an opportunity to take a look at some of those issues as you're going to be fashioning your budget proposals for the legislature?
Chief Justice Gilday.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, members, thank you for the question. The inquiry about what goes on the payables list and what doesn't is an ongoing inquiry. The Judicial Council, as the members probably know, is the policy-making body for the branch. And that's the body that makes those decisions. And we review the list regularly. We invite input from interested constituents, if you will, law enforcement, public defenders, municipalities have provided input. So it's an area of ongoing focus of the Judicial Council, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for being here. It's
a very serious conversation that has to occur in the state of Minnesota with the budget deficit we have, but we can't leave people without access to justice, and that leaves many of us in a very important role in advocating when you leave this room and amongst ourselves and our colleagues. My question is for Mr. Stewart, if he wouldn't mind answering a question. Mr. Stewart, I read the legislative auditor's report, and I've been concerned about the underfunding for the public defenders for quite some time. But I wanted to ask you about this Griffin case. I've not read it. And that's the one where you explained that the court dismissed the charges because there was no speedy trial in the case. And I wanted to ask you, what happened after that case? Was there a review of management? Was there a review of priorities? Why was this not that? Why was this a systemic issue in your mind, or is it a systemic issue in your mind? Can you just expand a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Stewart.
Senator Ortman, this is a case of a woman named Tamika Griffin from Chicago who was in a supermarket, and the police officer who was working a store security claims that he saw her eating grapes off of a bunch of grapes. And they got into kind of a brawl. She was actually from Chicago, and she was back and forth between Chicago and St. Paul many times trying to get this case resolved. At that time, the problem in Ramsey County was not having enough trial judges available to try the cases that were on the trial calendar every week. So they would take the cases first, as I think was a good idea, of folks who were in jail. And Ms. Griffin wasn't in jail. But she was one of the people that the court kept on a plan called the two-hour call-in, that for 8 months she was supposed to be available and her lawyer was supposed to be available on 2 hours' notice to come in and try this case. And over 8 months they did not get this done. She had demanded a speedy trial. She would have had a right to have had a trial within 60 days. So eventually she did get a trial. She was convicted, but the Court of Appeals said no. You put her through too much grief during that 8 months when she should have had a speedy trial. Now, I don't know if the justice system partners in Ramsey County could have done any better with that, because I think it makes sense to try the cases first of people that are in jail, but it has to do with maybe could cases that are going to get resolved sooner than the day of trial? Could there be more judges that would be assigned to the trial calendar? Ultimately, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office decided not to take that case up to seek review in the Supreme Court, and my understanding is that they understood why the Court of Appeals decided the way that they did. There was a similar case up north of State v. Faulkner. Mr. Faulkner fired a shotgun at a truck full of kids, and he was eventually convicted. And his case was thrown out because he had been sent for a mental health evaluation. It took 220-some days to get his case through the court system. He was lost on a court referral to mental health assessment for about 90 days. And everybody didn't make it their responsibility to keep an eye on him, and he fell through the cracks. And they said that he should not have been allowed to fall through the cracks. The problem is, as you've heard today, the cracks are getting bigger, and more people are going to be falling through.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have, according to the clock hanging from the ceiling, that clock is 4 minutes early. And so we can go in this room till 2:34 by reading that clock. I have three senators that have questions, Ingebrigtsen, Harrington, and Jungbauer. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, maybe the Chief Justice can answer this, but I've been around the law enforcement field for many years, and I want to throw a number out there. Maybe 12 years ago, the ITV thing came onto the scene. And there were some trial counties that were doing it, I think, out in the western part of the state. I happen to have taken advantage of the chair wanting us to mirror court here just recently, so I spent a half a day in the county court of Grant County, and where I did witness actually my first ITV felony probation violation hearing, and it worked quite well. Can you comment on that for those that may or may not know on the committee that is there, how that's working? Is it really saving you a lot of time, or is it something we can do better at or not?
Mr. Chair, Chief Senator Justice Ingebritz, and members, I appreciate the question very much. I think it's a wonderful innovation, and I think that it does save a lot of time for law enforcement in particular. For members who might not be familiar, if, for example, we have a defendant who's in custody in Meeker County and we don't have a judge sitting in Meeker County that day and the defendant is due to have his first appearance so a determination can be made whether he can get out of custody. We have a judge, let's say, who sits in Candiohi County, and the defendant and his lawyer are in the courthouse in Meeker County, and they're set up by video conferencing. The prosecutor will be with the defendant and the defense lawyer in Meeker County, and the judge is in Candiohi County, and the judge presides over the bail hearing in that fashion. It's not going to work in every context, but we think that it's something that works very, very well. When the ends of justice can be served that way, it can cut down on travel cost and the danger, frankly, that is created when offenders have to be transported. So we think it's a very, very good innovation, and we're working to encourage. I know Sheriff Stanek and the Stevens County Sheriff spoke to the judges in December about the value of this technology, and we're working to increase its use as appropriate. Thank you for the question, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Harrington.
Chief Justice Gilday, and this question is also for Mr. Backstrom. Several years ago, I was part of a Supreme Court task force on problem-solving courts, and I'm wondering how problem-solving courts have either impacted the court's calendar and or prosecutions, and are we seeing efficiencies versus greater effectiveness out of them?
Mr. Backstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Harrington, I'm a big supporter of problem-solving courts. I think they work effectively. I think they make a difference in people's lives. In Dakota County, we have four different problem-solving courts now, the most recent being an adult drug court, which I personally staff myself from the prosecution standpoint every Monday. And, you know, we're making big strides. You know, I think it's one of these issues, and I think it's a great question, because the concern about drug courts or problem-solving courts, whatever you want to refer to them as, is that it takes more intensive work up front, but we are saving a lot of money on the back end, because the folks that we're putting into our adult drug court, for example, many of which are first or second degree drug offenders with presumptive prison sentences. You know, the majority of those folks would be going to prison if we didn't send them to the drug court. And if we're successful in 80 to 90% of those cases and keeping them out of prison, you know, we're saving the state a lot of money on the back end. And I just think we need to make sure that thought process gets, you know, thought through. Because, yes, it does take some more court calendar time up front and some more intensive work from the public defender's office as well as the prosecutor's office and our law enforcement partners as well. But I think it's very meaningful work and very important.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, Chief. Members, thank you for the question. The drug courts, of course, are a very important part of the work that we do, and you need to be aware that we have had to close one of our drug courts in the state because of lack of funds. So the issue is very, very much in play. When we talk about ensuring adequate funding, we have to think about the drug courts, the problem-solving courts, very, very much when we're thinking about this question of adequate funding for the justice system. Okay. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Chief. Senator Jungbauer, you might have the last question of the day.
The last question and last word. Well, that's great. I came in a timely fashion. I get to leave in a timely fashion. Being new to the committee, I just kind of want to lay out something where I need help, and I'm a policy wonk and a numbers guy, and I spend a lot of time going over these things. And already I'm concerned when some people come in and tell me there's not enough money for certain things, and some of you did good and some of you didn't, so I'll pick on law enforcement for now. Because I hear we don't have enough money, and there's this inextricable link between laws and real public safety. So when I used to sit in transportation for 8 years and we passed a primary seatbelt law, and I see law enforcement have time to go out and have sting operations or saturation operations on primary seatbelt, and that isn't ostensibly a public safety issue, and then they're telling me we don't have money for something else, I want somebody to stand up and start figuring out this budget stuff. So really what I want to say is help me understand these things, show me what's working, show me where we need to fix things, but by gosh, they better have a link to public safety and not just somebody out there saying, well, we're enforcing the laws that you guys created. This decertifying and looking at something that's payable, I want to understand all these things. And I think a lot of new members, as well as people like myself that haven't served here before, we need to understand where can we change the system so that we're changing the way people think about the court system. We're changing the atmosphere of Minnesota, but we're not wasting your time and bogging you down. So really it's more of a statement that give me the facts, but don't stand here and say we're doing this great job and we need more money when I see some of these other things going on out there in the real world that tell me you got way too much money and way too much time on your hands.
Chief Kilday.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I didn't understand that so much as a question, as a request for help, and I will give you all the help that I can, and I have a wonderful staff, and we look forward to continuing the conversation with you on those subjects.
Thank you so much.
Members and Senator Jungbauer, we have about 2 weeks of trying to unravel and understand the issues presented to the courts. On Thursday, we'll be having representatives from the Supreme Court, the Appellate Court, District Court, as well as public defenders again before us, because there's no possible way we can understand the difficulties that this court has in just one meeting. So hopefully we'll be able to pull back the onion skin a little bit and understand it even more. Having no further business before the committee, this committee is adjourned.